Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Radio Westeros Live Scream. The horror of it all.
Hello and welcome. This is the Radio West inaugural live stream. I, as you can see, am Zombie Yoke Boy, and thanks to you all for tuning in. Today on this most horrid of Halloween nights, we bring you a selection of screams and scares that will leave you trembling in your bed tonight. George has written many horror stories in his time as a writer, and incorporates the genre with its archetypes and tropes into A Song of Ice and Fire. Today we will focus on the others, Qyburn and Robert Strong, The Night Fort, and more. So let me introduce you to our resident witch, Lady Gwyn.
Hello, hello, good evening everyone. Happy Halloween and welcome to the live scream, which was born, if you guys were with us a few weeks ago, it was born from a slip of the tongue. But so glad that we are here today. And we got lots of spooky things to talk about. And joining us for this discussion is our friend and fellow YouTuber, Mr. Joe Magician, Joseph Necromancer MD, I believe is his actual full name.
Yeah, I went full spook today for the month. That's what I changed my thing to on Twitter. Everyone for some reason calls me, well, actually Chloe calls me this. She calls me Dr. Magician MD, so I decided to just play into it.
Just nice.
I hope she realizes that was a joke for her. She probably does. Yeah.
Sure.
I am, of course, Joe Magician from the Joe Magician YouTube channel. Lots of spooky stuff over there. I got my special germ hat going with my emerald turtle, normally a prize for the streams when we read a certain amount of likes, but I figured dressing up as Gurm, I even got a shitty beard going just like Gurm.
There we go.
And a Stark shirt, so I think that's really all you need to pretend to be Gurm. Wear his memorabilia, have bad facial hair, and wear a hat. You got it.
Perfect. Okay, well, like you said, we got a lot to talk about. Before we get started, we're going to tell you, as usual, spoilers, everything. Tonight, we're going to add a trigger warning because we are talking about the worst of the worst characters, some of whom are guilty of some very bad atrocities. So there will be discussion of Gregor Clegane and some of the very terrible things that he has done to a lot of women of all ages. So bear that in mind. Otherwise, let's get started. Yoke Boy, what are we starting with?
We're going to start with those dastardly others, the icy zombies who plague the forests. And why don't we begin with a reading from the first prologue. The broken sword would be his proof. Garrod would know what to make of it. And if not him, then surely that old bear, Mormont, or Maester Aemon. Would Garrod still be waiting with the horses? He had to hurry. Will rose. Sir Waymar Royce stood over him. His fine clothes were a tatter, his face a ruin. A shard from his sword transfixed the blind white pupil of his left eye. The right eye was open, the pupil burned blue, it saw. The broken sword fell from nerveless fingers. Will closed his eyes to pray. Long, elegant hands brushed his cheek, then tightened around his throat. They were gloved in the finest moleskin and sticky with blood, yet the touch was icy cold. So, there's our first reading. We'll be doing several readings this evening. And the prologue of A Game of Thrones reads like a short story from the horror genre. Well, really, it is a short horror story. So my first question to you guys is, how does George build tension through this chapter, Lady Gwyn?
Well, he really uses all the elements of suspense, right? He's got language and imagery of fear and darkness prevailing there. The tension between the three characters is typical of horror and suspense, all that precedes, you know, the actual horrific events of the chapter. In fact, their interpersonal tension, it actually accentuates the building tension in the environment around them, which is going to crescendo in something wholly unexpected in the deaths of two of the three men.
I would answer that, first of all, George puts us in this wilderness. It's a place out of reach of men and their laws. And in the first line, he tells us we should start back, but they don't go back. Within the first few lines, we sense trouble is brewing, and it's Waymar's immediate cockiness that provides the obstacle to our character's safety. As Lady Gwyn said, this conflict causes the tension and suspense this horror story needs from the offset. Also in this opening gambit, Garrod says that men have no business with the dead. Here George is planting the notion of the undead into our unconscious mind. George takes the foreshadowing further with clever use of metaphor and simile. At one point, Waymar's cloak is described as looking like something half alive. Oh, half alive, I get it, George. Will becomes more afraid than he has ever been. Garrod and Will can sense danger. The reader certainly can. Yet Waymar will not listen until it's too late.
Oh, very spooky. I just want to say, I love that we're starting off with the Game of Thrones prologue, you know, thinking about Waymar and the others and everything about this chapter is one of my favorite things, as those who know my videos would know. I've made two videos and three live streams mostly about just this prologue. It's one of my favorites. And one critical way that he really builds his tension is, as you were talking about, Yoke Boy, through the setting. And as the sort of folks that would probably be reading a fantasy series, we're the kind of people that spend a lot of our lives indoors, warm and in comfort. George instead starts out the series with the opposite. He has his characters are in the deep, dark woods. They are cold and they feel like they are in danger. So instantly it's throwing you off. The woods themselves have this sort of primal fear in most people anyway, especially the dark, spooky ones of the aptly named Haunted Forest. I see you, George. I see you. It has to do with the fear that you can't see everywhere around you. There are hidden places everywhere. There could be predators. There could be someone tracking you. And he really plays that up through his characters. And then, of course, George confirms these fears in one crystallizing moment when he has the two expert rangers and the one green boy be attacked by camouflage murderous ice demons, which is maybe the personification of the worst thing you could imagine that would be lurking around the corner in the woods from you. It's like all of it bundled up into one crazy, scary thing. it's a distilled, like, primal fear that everyone has. Well, most people have when they go into the deep, dark, scary woods. But not only that, he creates tension by establishing that Will and Garrett are expert rangers. They know what they're doing. I mean, Waymar knows nothing. He's a dumbass. Okay, Waymar's the dumbass. But the other two, they should have full command of the scenario, as spooky and scary as it is. And he leverages that to push tension into your mind. He does a similar thing in other places, but notably with the Sand Snakes and Ario Hota. Ario Hota is established as a great warrior who's afraid of nobody until he comes across the Sand Snakes. And all of a sudden, all Ario can think about is how they're going to kill everyone around him, and he has to be afraid. It's a very clever way of George informing you of what you should be thinking about what's happening. And he does the same thing here. If these rangers who know everything and are totally prepared for what's happening are being spooked and uncomfortable and want to go back, he's telling you, even if you don't quite believe him, that in universe, this is like the scariest thing you can imagine. Their expertise, in a way, is being used against you as a reader.
Excellent. And as we heard in the reading at the end of the chapter, Waymar is resurrected as a sort of zombie. Why did George begin his magnum opus saga with horror? Because it's not really horror all the way through, isn't it? It's, if you took this chapter away, you don't enter horror when we're in Winterfell. So why did he begin there, Lady Gwyn?
Well, something we've said before is that prologues exist in epic fantasies to make promises to the reader. This one promises death and fear, which are two of the prevailing themes in this series. So if you think about it, death and fear are things that every single point of view character has to grapple with at some point. So not to mention darkness and devastation, which are all of which are present here. The prologue shows us where we're going, though the way is going to be long and meandering. And as for using the conventions of horror to show us this way, let's take a moment to nod to George's roots as a horror writer. In 2017, when he was discussing the development of his story Nightflyers for Sci-Fi, he commented about his forays into the horror genre, which were most notably the stories Sand Kings and Nightflyers, by saying the inspiration for both of those stories was a statement that I read somewhere by a critic to the effect that sci-fi and horror were opposites and fundamentally incompatible. As a lifelong fan of both, that assertion struck me as nonsense, so I set out to prove it wrong by blending the two genres together. So that worked out pretty well for him. Both of those things, stories stand as some of his most successful works. And in fact, before it was a TV series, Nightflyers was a movie, which was not all that well received. Nonetheless, George credits it with saving his career, which by the mid-80s had reached sort of a low point. I think this was around the time that he says he had actually considered becoming a real estate agent. That was immediately after Armageddon Rag, I think, but it was in that 80s, later 80s. Anyways, he says Nightflyers, the movie, was not a huge hit, but it's a film that I have very warm feelings toward. Nightflyers may not have saved my life, but in a very real sense, it saved my career, and everything I've written since exists in no small part because of that 1987 film. So to say that George loves horror, has a giant soft spot for it, actually credits it with, saving it, saving his career, which we should all be very thankful for. And, especially if he can weave it in with supposedly incompatible genres, that's all probably an understatement. So it's huge for him to include this in this epic fantasy.
Interesting stuff. Especially shrieks in horror when you said that it nearly ended his career.
I'm surprised he hasn't written like a story now as like a fantasy real estate agent, if that's like what was actually going through his head. So much of his stories are right. Autobiographical. How has that not made it into one by now? Come on, George.
Yes.
I know it's in there. Maybe Let's it's in Wild it. Cards.
Maybe he's got it somewhere.
Maybe that's Nimble Dick.
He's just showing you around the local places.
Oh, let me show you the Whisperers, a fine deal on this property.
Okay, getting back to the prologue and the question about why it's slotted in, given that it's not really a, saga all about horror. I think George wanted to bring immediate darkness to his saga to set a tone. Without the prologue, the setup on the whole would feel very different. But with fantasy prologues, you get to include something you otherwise couldn't. So here we get the best glimpse of the antagonist others in the first book. The horror angle captivates us and gives us an immediate adrenaline rush. While we're reading through the early Stark chapters, part of our brain is still wondering about those icy beings and the zombies. We are introduced to a form of magic, and so George is letting us know a lot about his fantasy world. With the others being a rather slow burn sort of enemy, they're often on the fringes of the story. This prologue seems essential in the setup of the saga as a whole. And the horror element, which really had to come with the others, is meant to be addicting and create instant and deep intrigue. Joe?
I'm still thinking about the idea of George R. R. Martin, real estate agent. The things he would point out. And actually, have you guys seen the stories about what he's doing in Santa Fe with his castle he's trying to get built in with his library and all that?
I didn't know about the castle, no.
Oh yeah, I knew he's building some sort of, it's like 1 foot too high or something.
It's the bigger problem is that it's a castle in the middle of Santa Fe. The court filings are amazing, but I guess he has not given up his interest in real estate. But back to the question. I recently guested on the Learning to Hands podcast with Maester Mary and Clint of the Laughing Tree, and the topic for that was also just the undead. We talked about the undead in depth legally and where they are in A Song of Ice and Fire. And when I was getting ready for that, I decided to just crack open George R. R. Martin's bibliography and just go through them and be like, how many of these actually feature the undead or zombies in some sense? And I just sort of gave up counting because it is near constant in a lot of his stories. I mean, we talked about Night Flyers. Meat House Man is basically a sci-fi zombie story. The Glass Flower sort of has it in a way where he asks the question, like, is Claire Namas actually alive? He does this thing all the time. So the idea that he would start off A Song of Ice and Fire with horror and go into these elements makes perfect sense because that's largely his pattern. He likes using these things to shock and draw you in a way that, I mean, there's other parts of A Song of Ice and Fire he wants you to read. There's obviously a lot of very random parts and different topics, but he as a writer very much believes that the best way to get somebody to keep reading is to scare the ever-living crap out of them. And that's sort of his pattern. And when you think about even this prologue and how it relates to his other chapters, I mean, when you think about Garrod and Will in the fear they feel in this chapter, that resonates further. He loves taking his characters and putting them in places where they are confronting the very, I mean, what's the phrase? The heart in conflict with himself. He likes pushing them exactly to the breaking point. Ned in King's Landing, Catelyn trying to win a war with Robb, Tyrion suddenly being desirable in power. He's putting his characters through the same thing that Will and Garrod are going through. They're confronting their worst fears, and it's often, much like happened to the two of them, breaking their world around him. George is a very cruel, cruel author. I also have many other thoughts about the prologue and my theory of Killing of a Ranger about how the others may have mistaken Waymar Royce for Jon Snow, but in a real way, the prologue is a preview for the long winding paths and the terrifying nature of what George is going to do to them. And in particular, Jon Snow. I mean, you don't have to believe my theory to understand that Jon Snow and Waymar Royce are big parallel characters, and that his story is likely going to go somewhere around the same path, leading to a fundamental test of his character about with all that he fears most. And will he be, you know, a man of the Night's Watch, or will he turn and run? That seems to be kind of the central thing he's trying to do to most of his characters, test them at that exact breaking point.
And as I said, the others really stay on the fringes of the story, don't they? Even as far as we've got five books in, they haven't made kind of monumental inroads. But one of the places that they appear, and it's off page, is at Hardhome. So I wondered what you think happened up at Hardhome with the supposed, you know, others' invasion there, and what are the dead things in the water and so on. So I think I'll begin here. After Mance's attack on the wall, the wildlings dispersed and some of them fled. However, they were vulnerable and desperate. Spiritualist Mother Mole had a vision of ships picking them up from Hardhome. It was kind of wishful thinking. And Hardhome itself does have a tragic history. There are others and whites in the vicinity, as we know. There are reports of wildlings eating their own dead. And then slaver ships come to Hardhome and start collecting the wildlings and take them off to perhaps a fate worse than death. Mother Mole really misunderstood her prophetic vision, and the Night's Watch ships do arrive, but it seems too late. Cotter Pike tells of dead things in the water. This could be whites trying to board the Night's Watch ships, or it could be sea life under the thrall of the others, which really gets our imaginations firing, doesn't it? I always imagine tentacles when I read that, but perhaps that's just me being hopeful. Cotter gives us a good, albeit fractured, account of what is happening up there. Although, in fact, it's Melisandre who might be our best resource in understanding what happened before the ships arrived with this vision. Snowflakes swelled from a dark sky and ashes rose to meet them, the grey and the white whirling around each other as flaming arrows arced above a wooden wall and dead things shambled silent through the cold. Beneath a great grey cliff where fires burned inside 100 caves. Then the wind rose and the white mist came sweeping in, impossibly cold, and one by one the fires went out. Afterward, only the skulls remained. And I think we can guess that that is Hardhome that Melisandre is thinking about because of the description of the great cliff. So that's how Hardhome is described. So what do you have to say about this subject, Lady Gwyn?
Well, first I want to just say that the use of the word shambled there, dead things shambled through the cold. Nothing that was ever up to any good has ever shambled. So if you see that word in a sentence, you're dealing with horror pretty much, so. Just an observation. As far as what's happening, you know, the dead things in the water really fascinate me. I've been talking about it quite a bit. We talked about it over in our patron Discord this week, and we talked about it last night on the Ice and Fire Con panel. I am fascinated by it on a couple of levels. What they are, I don't know. Could they be, you know, zombies, or not really, maybe not yet zombies, or corpses left over from whatever happened at Hardhome 600 years ago, when we were told the waters were choked with swollen corpses? Could they just be things that have been lying in wait? And wait for it, because I'm going to tell you what I think the inspiration for this passage is, which, as you said, comes from this Cotter Pike's desperate letter to John in A Dance with Dragons. I think it comes from two parts of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. In the final entry, when in the Fellowship of the Ring, when they're in the Mines of Moria, or Khazad Dûm, as the dwarves call it, the final entry in the book they find there is about as creepy as it comes. It's written, "We cannot get out, we cannot get out. They've taken the bridge in the second hall. Frere and Loni and Nali fell there bravely, while the rest retreated to the chamber of Mazarbul. We are still holding out hope. Oyn's party went 5 days ago, but today only four returned. The pool is up to the wall at the west gate. The watcher in the water took Oyn. We cannot get out. The end comes soon. We hear drums. Drums in the deep. They are coming." So if you read Cotter Pike's letter, in tone, they are so similar to that. I mean, it's just the desperate plea of someone, you know, looking for help that probably isn't coming. And then, of course, also in The Lord of the Rings, the second influence is in from the Two Towers. You, Sam and Frodo and Gollum traverse the dead marshes of the Imin Muel. And we had a quote from that too, which is also very creepy. Hurrying forward, Sam tripped, catching his foot in some old root or tussock. He fell and came heavily on his hands, which sank deep into sticky ooze, so that his face was brought close to the surface of the dark mirror. There was a faint hiss. A noisome smell went up. The lights flickered and danced and swirled. For a moment, the water below him looked like some window glazed with grimy glass through which he was peering. Wrenching his hands out of the bog, he sprang back with a cry. There are dead things, dead faces in the water, he said with horror. Dead faces. So that one, I think, is a little bit more on the nose. There's literal dead things in the water. Also worth mentioning that there are dead things in the water in Harry Potter when he and...
Inferni, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, which, I suppose that probably comes from this same influence of Tolkien. So I just definitely, I find that very fascinating. Tolkien, for what it's worth, attributes this sort of imagery to things he saw in France in the greatest horror story of them all, World War I's Battle of the Somme. Although some medievalists also point out that the descriptions are very reminiscent of Grendel's Wilderness in Beowulf, which would have been Tolkien's area of study. But the imagery is very deep. The influences for this passage are very deep, which is probably why they fascinate me. Although deep as the influences are, I think the things in the water might in fact be quite shallow. Just ready to grab you.
So dead things in the water, Joe, have you got any thoughts about this?
I do, but one thing I was thinking about while I was listening to this is, yes, Tolkien probably, maybe Beowulf and that kind of thing, but I was also wondering, because of where these chapters take place, do you think George saw Pirates of the Caribbean? Do you think he saw that scene with the dead climbing up the ropes? He is a pack rat. He loves taking things from everywhere and putting it in. If you wanted to think about, like, skeletons climbing out of the water and sacking ships or something like that, there would be no better recent example than that. I don't know if he's seen Pirates of the Caribbean, but it certainly does sound similar.
Probably has, and it does. You're right. Yeah.
And so for, like, what happened there, the one thing to key in on from Melisandre's description is, of course, I think the White Mists. That's how Tormund describes the others. Like, we know them as, we saw them in the prologue, as the Ice Demons, but apparently that's a recent thing. Tormund and the rest of the Wildlings consider them mostly to be cold white mists that always hung around the edge of their encampments that for some reason recently have started to, I guess, take form. Maybe that's why they've been hanging around for so long. Tormund essentially just goes like, well, how do you kill a mist? Like, how do you swing a sword through something like that? It's like, okay, that makes sense. And then the dead thing shambling through the cold, those are whites. The part that I think that always gets people about the dead things in the water part is actually the water, not really the dead things, because the others and their whites sort of create an obvious question, and that is, why don't they go around the wall? Why don't they go under the water around the wall and walk through? Their whites are dead. They don't need to breathe. They don't need to eat. Surely they could just go around it. So this kind of creates It creates sort of a problem in people's heads where they're like, okay, well, they can go into the water. If they're at Hardhome and they're dead things in the water, or maybe the others showed up and they raised corpses out of the harbor, that would be sort of their thing to do. That's actually something that I wondered about with the oncoming maybe Eldritch apocalypse at Old Town, or maybe an attack on White Harbor. There's always corpses in harbors. People, they get dumped in there, they fall off ships, ships go down. There's always going to be bodies there to raise. But if the others can raise things underwater and send them underneath, why haven't they? And it raises a bigger question about the wall and exactly like what it can do. Because if they can go under the water, what's stopping them? So the only explanations you have is they are holding back for some reason. There's some reason they're not using this obvious way to go around it like every other wildling with a boat has figured out for thousands of years. Or there's something else very magical about the wall that extends beyond the actual physical, ice barriers, as it were. The same for Gorn's Way. We know there are many ways through the wall, though others could be attacking at any time. So this sort of creates a bit of foreshadowing for maybe for you to puzzle out as a reader through the Winds of Winter, like, how are they going to get through? Well, it might be a very magical solution they have to go after. The show did this with the weird mark on Bran and the dragon thing. I don't really know about that, but it's creating a good deal of foreshadowing and puzzle solving in his readers for what exactly is he going to do with this. But it also sets up a lot of, like I was talking about with White Harbor, a lot of people think, well, actually, maybe it was you guys that said this, or it might have been History of Westeros, that White Harbor might be White Harbor, not white as in the color, but white as in W-I-G-H-T, and that one of the big attacks from the others may come there. And this may be George setting up through Hardhome a very horrific scene where the very nice and wonderful Manderlys are torn apart by the dead things in the water, as it were.
Yeah.
I don't want that to happen. White Harbor seems great.
I know. I want to see the merman's court, like, you know.
The merman's court's going to be an undead merman's court.
I don't like that. But.
Well, that's really a different discussion, how far they're going to get. But on the subject of the horror of the others, I was wondering how, after the prologue and after what we've seen with Othor and heard about Hardhome, how is George going to inflict a new level of horror on us when the others really show up for real? You know, how can he raise the bar? Surely he hasn't played his best horror hand yet, and surely he wouldn't have done that in the very first prologue. So how is he going to elevate things, Lady Gwyn?
Well, you know, zombies, whose masters also bring devastating and, dare I say, largely unsurvivable weather, is going to lead to whole new levels of human-inflicted horror. I mean, it's bad enough you got the others and their undead army and whatever. You know, that's true horror. But, you know, the fear and desperation that rolls before them is going to lead to something George loves to talk about. Humans engaging in all manner of horrific and inhuman behavior all on their own. Cannibalism, neighbor versus neighbor. I mean, those might be the least of it. But I expect that a great deal of the horror that we're going to see is going to be man versus man, not, you know, nature versus man or the other kinds of things.
I think this is a theme we're going to be coming back to very shortly. But just talking about the others, I think that the most devastating thing for us as readers would be if a character that we really like and enjoy gets whited and suddenly they're sort of undead slaves for the opposition, and you know you can't like them anymore. In fact, you've got to want them to die. So that's a hell of a switch from loving this character to wanting them to be burned. It doesn't really have to be a major character, just someone we like being completely corrupted, someone like Hodor or something like that. That's possible. Also think there has to emerge some kind of hierarchy with the others that we're not yet aware of. I know the TV show did that from the offset, and I don't think it'll be like for like at all, but I'd be surprised if there isn't some kind of hierarchy so we can see the order of the, you know, so we can see who's the baddest of the bad, have a target that we want to take down. What do you think, Joe?
Yeah, that's the whole hierarchy thing, and that there has to be someone to focus on. The others are largely faceless at this point. They are basically like faceless men. We don't know anything about them. So for them to become a real villain, they must in some way reflect something horrible about our characters. Some people have theorized that this means that there will be a connection maybe between the Starks and the others. I mean, they are the Kings of Winter and all the other various like history that goes in around them, even the story of the Night King maybe being a Stark by Old Nan, who was always right. So that's probably true. But I really think the hardest hitting part of this will probably be at the Crypts of Winterfell. And George has set this up in a very, very, very particular way. For one thing, the Starks, for some reason, as kids, played in the crypts. Like, they're just, like, running around statues, pretending to be ghosts, jumping out at each other. And it's like, haha, what an adorable little thing. I'm like, George, what are you doing? What are you doing with these kids in these crypts? This seems like something very ominous. The show did sort of a version of this where Sansa and Tyrion were down in the crypts with a bunch of the helpless people during the Siege of Winterfell, and all the bodies jumped out of the tombs and started attacking. But what was missing about that is honestly the way that they had to narrow the show. And that is that we don't know most of the characters in the show that are in those crypts. The only, like, named person we really care about is Ned. And as far as the books are concerned, he's not in there yet. But as book readers, we know quite a lot of characters and have attachments to them that are already down there. Lyanna Stark is down there. Brandon Stark. Rickard Stark. Eventually, maybe Ned. Lady Dustin has been on the lookout for his corpse in a very weird way that seems like George is hinting towards something. But there's a very real chance that rather than just being a bunch of guys jumping out of tombs, that these are characters that the Starks, and in particular, the crypts have a very strong meaning for Jon. He has dreams about them all the time. He thinks about it in terms of identity. So I would guess that George's big thing the others will do will probably have to do with the crypts of Winterfell, and probably Ned, but maybe Lyanna too. Like, what if Lyanna is reanimated as a skeleton and starts to attack Jon, and he's already realized who she is? That would be a horrifying moment for his POV to go through. And that's the kind of, when you think of, this is my rule for when you're trying to prank George. What's the worst thing you could do? What's the thing that will hurt you the most as a reader? And I think it would be John and Ned's kids confronting the people in the crypts they know, rather than, like I said, just random whites popping up.
Several of them are missing their swords. So, you know, that iron that supposedly keeps them from rising. So
just burn the corpses. Why didn't the Starks do that? It's like George is saying, these guys are definitely going to jump up and mess people up.
Yes.
No one else does this. They're the only ones that do it.
Oh, yeah. Iron. That'll never rust away or get moved or anything. That'll be fine forever.
There's no necromancers just a little bit north that might use these bodies. It's like they're idiots.
Just waiting.
So the crypts could be the place for some screams, maybe in the final book. So we've covered some of the horror of the undead. So next we're going to refocus on the horror of the living, what man can do to man. And to begin, Joey's going to do a reading of Gregor versus Oberyn.
Oh, God, this quote. They wrestled in the dust and blood, the broken spear wobbling back and forth. Tyrion saw with horror that the mountain had wrapped one huge arm around the prince, drawing him tighter against his chest, like a lover. Okay. Ilya of Dorne, they all heard Sir Gregor say, when they were close enough to kiss. His deep voice boomed within the helm. I killed her screaming whelp. He thrust his free hand into Oberyn's unprotected face, pushing steel fingers into his eyes. Then I raped her. Clegane slammed his fist into the Dornishman's mouth, making splinters of his teeth.
Wow.
I didn't catch up on the sexual chemistry that George was putting in there. That's a weird thing he did with this.
Yeah.
Scene.
Yeah, just hearing it read aloud.
I like, never noticed that before. That's a choice.
Ew.
Gregor Clegane, what can be said about the mountain? He's often called a monster in story and without. So what exactly has he done to earn that name? And are we being fair on this guy, Lady Gwyn? Or has he got a soft heart underneath all that armor?
What? That's a...
Okay. Shoot me down.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we just kick you out of the stream right now for that. No, I mean, where to start with him? He's just really one of the true human monsters of the story, long before he becomes an undead horror. Rumors abound about him that he killed his own family, his father, his sister, his first two wives, which implies that he has a third wife kicking around somewhere. God, that scares me. I'm scared for her. We know he mutilated his little brother in a dispute over a toy, which their father was apparently too scared of Gregor to discipline him for that. He raped and murdered Elia Martell, killed her son, as we just heard. We also hear later that he raped an innkeeper's daughter, or actually that was a gang rape, but he presided over it. There was the servant girl Pia, which was multiple occasions, and one of Lord Bracken's daughters. He led the horrific rape and pillage of the village of Sharer, which led to Ned attainting him and sending Beric Dondarrion out to execute him. He eventually killed 8-year-old Lord Lyman Darry when he took Castle Darry, and generally runs around setting the Riverlands aflame with brutal sacking and pillaging and killing and more rape and murder. That's just what he does. Note that he does not limit himself to injuring small folk or weak and powerless people. He routinely targets people of his own or higher social class, people like Elia Martell and Lord Bracken's daughter and little Lord Lyman Darry, people that he could have maybe, you know, captured and held for ransom in the normal sort of course of medieval warfare, right? So I think clearly, in my opinion, he's the worst of George's human monsters, which is saying something. And that was before he became an undead monster, Robert Strong. So we have yet to see what Robert Strong is capable of. But I expect it to be, you know, supersized Gregor, more worse, more horrible.
Yeah. What you've taken us through there was an unbelievable list of terrible deeds carried out by Gregor. It's interesting to talk about him after we've talked about the others. Those others are deadly, remorseless, dark-hearted, and use their magic to facilitate this evil. Gregor, though, is a human character who is every bit the monster that the others are. Clegane is a discredit to the human race, and those who utilize him are also tainted. It's not a great surprise that this guy is Tywin's dog. Altogether, Gregor is a walking crime against humanity, and that was when he was alive.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Yeah, there's no like, is Gregor, is it unfair to call him a monster? He definitely is a monster. Although, interestingly, George does try to give you a little bit of empathy with the weird detail that due to his giganticism, he has terrible headaches and he's always drinking milk of the poppy, which I guess means that he's kind of stoned all the time. It doesn't excuse anything, but it's just like, is that the explanation we're going for?
Yeah, and also that he's in pain and that he might be continually in pain. Again, it's not an excuse, but there's some small amount of pathos, right?
Little, like the tiniest bit. There's like some humanity in there behind the monster. But I think Gregor is specifically designed to be the worst thing because he's set up to be sort of the anti-Duncan the Tall or anti-Bran of Tarth. George has this love of these gigantic, good-hearted characters who always do the best thing, except for Sandor, but that's because of Gregor's influence on him like a corrupting force. Gregor seems to be almost him doing a twist on that. Somebody, like, every decision point that you read in through Duncan the Tall's story, imagine if he did the opposite. And that's kind of where you get with Gregor. It's almost like an intellectual exercise for him to make the worst guy he could. But one thing that I find really interesting about Gregor is the closeness of Gregor to George. And considering that George is the one writing this, I wonder if it's almost like a little joke on himself that, like, this is how his characters perceive him, because he's doing all these terrible things to all these people. He's very self-reflective about it in one of his other stories, the Portraits of Their Children, where the characters essentially come to life and confront the author and say, why are you doing this to me? Well, Gregor may be like his own place in for the his own imagination's cruelty on his own story.
And Oberyn wanted to bring justice to Gregor. Weren't we all behind him? But he ended up giving his life for the cause. Maybe a touch of arrogance crept in, or more than a touch. Does it feel then like a cheap shot after the death of Oberyn that Gregor ends up being resurrected? You know, why would George resurrect him? Cheap shot or not? What do you think, Lady Gwyn?
No, I think there's unfinished business with Gregor, you know, Gregor and Sandor. They both reached a point where they were thought to be dead, or, you know, by people in the story, but they're really not. And I think the purpose behind both of those story arcs, as divergent as they are, is because there's unfinished business between those two characters. But it's also a great opportunity for George to inject more horror into his story and make Gregor even worse, as if that's possible. But I think it is, and we're going to see how possible it is coming up.
Well, yeah, worse, or if not, he's just the same. He's just the same, just a killing machine. I mean, he was like this when he was alive. He was
just a killing machine that you can't kill.
He would serve his masters and do whatever the hell they told him to do, all the worst stuff. But the undead storyline was already well seeded when Gregor was brought back, so it wasn't too much of a surprise, and there was grounding for it. And in this sense, it didn't feel cheap. There has been speculation that magic has been re-emerging in this world since the birth of the dragons. So we can imagine if you were a necromancer, now would be your time, right? So Gregor's reanimation does make sense, I think. I think story-wise, Gregor is a lot of power within one man. In the short term, he can serve Cersei and help her to get a sure footing as she tries to bounce back from the disempowerment she felt at the Walk of Shame, while showing shades of Tywin thematically. Like I said, Tywin used his dog. In the longer term, it might be that Sandor has a date with destiny, Lady Gwyn mentioned this, to fight his big bully brother to the death. I have to say, the show's portrayal of both men dying in a great fire really works well for both characters. Sandor finally going and facing his fear in the last moments of his life, and Ungregor the White perhaps perishing by the only thing that could kill him, the flames. So what do you think, Joe?
I do wonder about Clegane Bowl, because it does seem that, I believe there's quotes about it, that Dan and Dave were essentially responding to the fandom yearning for it, and that's why they made it happen. Some have said that maybe it will happen at Trial by Seven. I don't think that one's going to happen. Sandor is still injured, I believe, on the Quiet Isle, right? He has a limp. So probably wouldn't be a match for him. But I do like the idea that eventually they will face each other, and the whole fire thing that created them, essentially bodied them together, will be the thing that ends both of their lives. That does have a good thematic resonance to it. Like you were saying, I don't think it's a very cheap thing to have Gregor come back. I think one of the main reasons is that a lot of the characters that in universe people that the characters want to come back are good people, or they want them to come back to like resume the place, the good things they were doing in their life. Like Arya asks, is it possible to bring back a Skull, thinking about Ned. Lady Stoneheart apparently has some sort of weird thing where she wants to bring back Rob. I mean, I don't quite understand what she's hoping for considering her own situation, but there's a lot of trying to recapture the past. And George is sort of saying like, no. Gregor is the example that is one of the examples that the resurrection he's going to have his characters go through is going to be a massive cost, that it's going to be something they will not like at all. And it also serves to show that the way of justice that a lot of characters seem to be seeking is a fool's errand. Oberyn got his best shot at the guy who did him the most wrong, basically. And what did George do to him? He smashed his face in and then had the guy survive poison that no one else should. And now he may be functionally immortal. And it's like, wow, that one really blew up in your face, Oberyn. And that's sort of a lesson for the rest of the story going forward. Like, don't look for justice here. This ain't coming.
That's a great point there about Oberyn not knowing what he was doing there, not knowing what he was unleashing.
Yeah, especially if he goes after the Sand Snakes. Like, Nymeria and Tyene are both going to be in King's Landing. If more of the women that Oberyn loves end up dying by Grigor's hand, I mean, that's, again, the whole, what would George do? The worst thing possible. that would be it.
At the least, they're going to witness the monstrosity, and they're going to be writing back to Dawn, guess who I just saw? Guess who was just in the by the Iron Throne?
How is anybody fooled by this? How is no one put together that the 8-foot guy is Gregor Clegane? Like, come on.
Well, Kevin has, because he noticed that he doesn't shit anymore.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's heavily implied in the Kevin.
The guy doesn't go to the toilet. He's good at holding it in.
The whole small council.
Of course,
like,
the whole court must be abuzz with like,
yeah, that guy.
That's Gregor, isn't it? Yeah, right? It must be.
The way I see it is everybody's just kind of like, we know, but we're just not going to say anything because we just don't know what, they're all like, I'm going to look over here and just pretend I don't see it. And then the Sand Snakes are going to show up and they're going to be like, what the?
We saw his head. Wait a second.
That's Gregor. That's Gregor. Like, they even say, if another such as him, when they're talking about whether he's still alive, one of them says to Doran, if another such as him, 8 feet tall, shows up in the kingdom, we'll know that Cersei screwed us over with his head, So they're going to show up in King's Landing and find an 8-foot tall guy standing right next to Cersei and just be
very
like,
sus.
Who is this guy? Can I see his birth certificate? He doesn't poop.
Poop is going to go down.
No poop is going to go
doesn't
down.
Doesn't do anything.
He doesn't. Speaking of poop, he does not do that.
That was one of the weird things where they were just like, yeah, the guy doesn't go to the bathroom. Like, that's the thing you're questioning about the 8-foot tall mute, that he doesn't use the bathroom?
Okay, on the subject of Gregor in his head, I want just a one sentence answer from all of you real quick. Gregor crushed Oberyn's head, but what happened to his own? What the heck is under Robert Strong's helmet, guys? Lady Gwyn?
Well, we once had a theory about Rob's head being... But I believe his own ugly, undead head is what's there under his helmet.
I tend to agree that it's probably just his own head, but my favorite tinfoil I've heard about it is that it's Robert Baratheon's head, that they dug up his corpse and it's a present to Cersei to make her dead, horrible husband her basically undead slave.
I just don't want to think, does the head have a will of its own? Is he going to start eating all the boar and all the fruits around? Okay, I think either his own head or some kind of comedy stitching monstrosity like the dwarf's head. Now that would be creepy horror, so I'd go for it. It probably is just his own head, and they've sent the fake skull to Dawn. But you can't rule out Qyburn sort of stitching something on like some kind of horror B-movie. Okay, and on the subject of horror B-movies, let's talk about Qyburn, why don't you begin us, Lady Gwyn, with another reading?
Okay. This is Cersei talking to Qyburn. This man, Bronn, I cannot say I like the notion of an enemy so close. His power all derives from Lawless. If we were to produce the elder sister... Alas, said Qyburn, I fear that Lady Felice is no longer capable of ruling Stokeworth, or indeed of feeding herself. I have learned a great deal from her, I am pleased to say, but the lessons have not been entirely without cost. I hope I have not exceeded your grace's instructions.
Oh dear, this passage, really, when I read it, I was just so creepy. It creeped me out more than anything, I think, in terms of the actual making your skin crawl and giving you goosebumps. So what I was going to ask you guys first, what do you think are the inspirations for Qyburn? Some of them are obvious, and perhaps there are some less obvious ones that you might know. Lady Gwyn?
Yeah, I mean, I think you get the ultimate necromancer, Victor Frankenstein. Shelley's novel is subtitled The Modern Prometheus, so there's an indirect influence as well. Prometheus is the character who created man from clay, while Frankenstein created his creature from human remains after studying chemistry and decay in living beings. Qyburn tells Cersei, for hundreds of years the men of the Citadel have opened the bodies of the dead to study the nature of life. I wish to understand the nature of death, so I open the bodies of the living. For that crime, the Grey Sheep shamed me and forced me into exile. But I understand the nature of life and death better than any man in Old Town. So he's basically saying that he's a vivisectionist right there, which...
Yes, and necromancer, so a great combination. There are definitely similarities, as Lady Gwyn said, with Frankenstein and his monster. But of course, George goes several shades darker. Qyburn reminds me of something, like I said, from a horror B-movie. The insane Nazi vivisectionist, or something like that. I'm sure you understand the trope that I'm trying to communicate there. But rather than making the man look as horrid as his deeds are, George makes him look, as Cersei thinks, like your favourite grandfather. He's got the look of someone you can trust, but downstairs in his basement laboratory, there's people with pieces of their bodies missing in the name of his science. So, yeah, he looks rather lovely, but he's got one of the darkest hearts in the series. What do you think, Joe? Who's the inspirations?
Oof. Well, the whole thing about the not being able to feed herself and the way that line is written reminds me just like heavily of Hannibal Lecter. The way that he experiments with people's bodies. I mean, he eats them. I don't think Qyburn's doing that, but certainly it seems like he's going for a similar idea, especially since most people find Hannibal Lecter to be a charming personality. And he's very popular in Baltimore before he starts, you know, killing and eating people, that kind of thing. Especially, he also has an amateur's interest in vivisection. That's part of the thing he gets out of it. So that may be something. But I also wanted to dip into the realm of Lovecraft, because the whole idea of the mad guy, the mad scientist in the basement doing things no one can understand, but sort of flies under the radar by clutching the power or being just too charming, is something Lovecraft used quite often. A lot of his characters are like that. But the most famous one is obviously Herbert West from the story Herbert West Reanimator, where Herbert and his assistant essentially ran around to graveyards and were digging up bodies, much like Frankenstein. It's kind of like his own take on the Frankenstein story. But the mannerisms of Herbert West and the way he talks about what he's doing seems very, very similar to Qyburn. And especially with the what happens in the end, that Herbert West doesn't essentially create monsters in the end. Several of them, I think. And he seems very much just like a Lovecraft character taken whole cloth from one of the old stories and plopped into this one.
So some ideas about the genesis of Qyburn as a character there. I'm sure that he's taken bits from numerous places, as we're suggesting, as seems to be this pattern with character development. So Qyburn is very odd. Even though he looks like a grandfather, he's an oddball. You know, he's lost his chain. You know that something's wrong with him. It's the stuff he comes out with and the things he's interested in. So why does Cersei, who's got hefty kind of ideals where she sees herself, she wants to be the very top. Why is she palling up with Qyburn, Lady Gwyn?
Well, thank you for asking this, because it gives me yet another opportunity to roll my eyes at Cersei, who really pals up with every, you know, unsuitable person she can get her hands on in A Feast for Crows. Like, let's face it. So what Qyburn offers at first is this kind of utter obsequiousness, willingness to do whatever she asks him to do. Later on, she becomes enamored of his talents for making people talk, or making inconvenient people stop talking. And also the fact that he is utterly amoral. I do think that she is attracted by that. It says she's fascinated by his claims about understanding the nature of life and death, and that quote I read earlier. But, you know, initially, all it took for him to catch her attention was a, "Yes, ma'am, whatever you say, ma'am."
Yeah, and I think that Qyburn facilitates Cersei's worst impulses. In the cases of Felice and others, Cersei shows no emotion, knowing, or perhaps not quite knowing, the fate that she'd bestowed on them. She really has no conscience, and when Qyburn starts delivering her requests, she is then her perfect go-to man. In reanimating Sir Gregor, he has literally breathed new life into House Lannister, and that's something we'll be seeing a lot of in The Winds of Winter. We're going to see how powerful Robert Strong is. If Gregor was effective as a human, what the heck is he going to be like now he's undead? He's almost like a machine, and for the time being at least, he's devoted wholly to Cersei, but via Qyburn.
So I think the reason that Cersei values Qyburn so much has to do with the way that she normally gets people to do what she wants. And it's largely through fear and intimidation or sexuality. She either threatens them with death or essentially says, let's go to the bone zone, as it were. Qyburn is devoted to her in a way that it seems to be attracted to her personality and her rulership style, that they kind of feed off of each other. It's one of the few people that I think from Cersei's perspective may feel like a true believer in her rule, rather than somebody that is just tolerating her until the next person comes along. I think that has a lot to do with it. And also the fact that, like, Qyburn's one of the few people that is willingly helping her. I mean, she's paying him and she's given him power, but it seems like he's on board with pretty much everything. And she doesn't really have someone like that in her life.
Yeah, I agree. He is, like I said, he's delivering on these, you know, he's promising her things, but he's coming through, and no one else is helping her since Tywin's gone. From that moment, she's been a bit of a lost soul, but
he lets her feel like Tywin. It's like her own little Kevin.
Yeah, and she just does not seem to care about the methods he uses. So, talking about the methods, why don't we briefly speculate what the hell happens in this horror episode down in Qyburn's basement, Lady Gwyn?
Well, we had a taste of his ability to torture with the scene with the blue bard, but it's really that Felice quote is really the only inkling we have of what he's doing with the women Cersei gives him. Prior to Felice, in case you missed it, she gave him her maid Sennel, about whom Qyburn later says just this: "Alas, the poor girl is quite exhausted," which prompts Cersei to give him these two female puppeteers, whose show depicting a dragon devouring a lion she had found treasonous. And then he tells her, well, the puppeteers are quite used up. So that's when she gives him Felice. It's all very vague, but it's extremely evocative of this sort of Silence of the Lambs sort of thing. Like Joe was saying, you know, it's definitely got that vibe. So is his statement about Felice indicates that she's still alive, if somewhat damaged, perhaps even vegetative, which I said shed some new light on those statements about the other three women that he made previously. So last night I was on a panel over on the Ice of Fire Con YouTube channel. We were talking about zombies, and I was speculating that maybe he used their blood to replace Gregor's poisoned blood. You know, Gregor's blood is noted to have been, you know, to be this kind of black, you know, really polluted by the poison that Oberyn used. So, you know, maybe he had to do some sort of blood transfusion. Actually, even as I said that, did the show do something like that?
Yeah, there was a blood replacement scene in the show.
I don't know. I guess that was something from my subconscious. Maybe it wasn't really an original thought. But anyways, could be that. It could be, you know, people wonder if something about the creative power of the female body is part of his magic or whatever he's doing.
Yeah, I have seen various theories on what you're talking about there, Lady Gwyn. And for me, personally, I think George maintains this element of ambiguity on purpose. No one knows exactly what's happening with Felice, and it's exactly this unknown that creates the horror. This is why I find it more creepy than anything, because perhaps if it was described, it would be horrific, but at least I'd know what was going on. When it's left to our imaginations, we can only think the worst. So sometimes that kind of unknown is worse than the most graphic of details. Joe?
So one of the things that he talks about, I think this is more played up in the show, but I believe it happens in the books too, that he really wonders about the border between life and death, and that he likes thinking about where exactly, well, how far you can push a body, how far you can push somebody until they finally break down, and understanding the internal organs and that kind of thing. So like you guys were talking about vivisections, he's probably like taking notes the whole time, and at some point he's going to publish like his own very horrific textbook about how the internal workings of bodies work. So usually people do that with corpses, but Qyburn, that's not enough for Qyburn. He wants to see the exact moment of death, which I think lends to the idea that he has found somewhere in between to keep Gregor, that's where his studies have kind of taken him. I don't know. There's this one very creepy scene in one of the later Hannibal movies where he takes off somebody's skull and then like feeds their own brain to them, that kind of thing. And I have to imagine that's the sort of thing that George is probably calling on here, that there's maybe like lobotomies. Like the brain, if you're talking about the border between life and death, it has to do with the brain more than any of the others. So you have to assume that's what Qyburn is focusing on with the women.
Yeah, if I do this, what happens over there?
Right, maybe he has some primitive way where he's poking them and seeing what happens, which is stimulus essentially response. How, in real life, that's how medical professionals learned how they work. They mostly did them on animals, but Qyburn's a horror story character, right. So he's doing them on real people.
Yes.
Alive people. Don't worry about it, Qyburn. Yeah. Okay, so to finish up with Qyburn and Robert Strong, because we've looked at both of them, I wonder, will Robert Strong turn on his master? This is a kind of trope. Why don't you explain it, Lady Gwyn?
Well, you know, sure. Frankenstein's monster turned on him. I mean, I hope it's not too much of a spoiler if you haven't read Frankenstein to tell you that his monster turned on him, killed his little brother, and maybe also his fiance, if I remember correctly. You know, swore his undying hatred to him, ran away. You know, basically turned on his creator. So surpassed his creator, turned on him. I mean, it's just that ultimate sort of, you know, master and pupil trope. But we should never forget that Robert Strong started out as Gregor. So in my opinion, he's unlikely to be controlled by his creator, Qyburn, indefinitely, because I mean, if there's any bit of Gregor left inside of him, which I have to assume there is a whole lot of it, that's going to come out, and he's going to be, you know, Gregor the evil monster. So
that's a great point. I think that Gregor might have done his master's bidding wherever he was asked, but still he did kill one of his own men for snoring. I think there's still a bit of Gregor left in Robert Strong for sure, and one day it might just burst out. Okay, so next on our agenda is a place which gives Bran the creeps thoroughly, even before he ends up there. It's the Nightfall, everyone. Every reader of A Song of Ice and Fire knows that this is the creepiest location. So I'm going to begin with a short reading. Jojen gazed up at him with his dark green eyes. "There's nothing here to hurt us, Your Grace." Bran wasn't so certain. The Nightfall had figured in some of Old Dan's scariest stories. It was here that the Night's King had reigned, before his name was wiped from the memory of man. This was where the Rat Cook had served the Andal King his prince and bacon pie, where the 79 Sentinels stood their watch, where brave young Danny Flint had been raped and murdered. This was the castle where King Sherritt had called down his curse on the Andals of old, where the prentice boys had faced the thing that came in the night, where blind Simeon Star-Eyes had seen the hellhounds fighting. Mad Axe had once walked these yards and climbed these towers, butchering his brothers in the dark. So that's just a brief reading to outline how creepy the Night Fort is. So I was going to ask, first of all, why does George bring Bran here? Joe, have you got any ideas?
Well, for one thing, a lot of Bran's early chapters have to do with him having very naive ideas and enjoying things that he tells old Nan that his favorite stories are the scary ones. And it's like, well, they're only scary because, I mean, he only likes them because they are far away from you. You would not want to be in any of those stories. Yeah, in the same way, like, a lot of people like slasher movies. You would not want to be one of the people running from Jason Voorhees. That would be horrific. So George is essentially having Bran live the scary stories that he doesn't like, and it's serving as kind of his long-term growing up Bran very, very quickly since he abandoned the five-year gap strategy. The same thing happens when he meets the three-eyed raven, where Bran's like, oh, well, he must be like a wizard in a tree. It'll be amazing. We'll be best friends forever. And Bloodraven is instead a weird corpse ingrained in a weirwood, and Bran's like, well, I'll be able to walk again. And Bloodraven's like, no, man, that's not happening. So it's kind of, I think that's the main purpose of it. He's showing Bran the truth of the world and how the stories and the future that he wants for himself is probably going to be a lot worse once he gets to it.
And Bran's story as a young man in a scary world is a lot about fear. Like you said, it begins with these stories that he's kind of been fed. Even when there was peace, he was interested in these stories. A young boy coming to terms with life and all the scary things. Yet his world is turned upside down, and suddenly he's not in his bedroom listening to these stories. As Joe said, he's living them. He has to deal with his fear. The line from Ned, "The only time a man can be brave is when he's afraid," is really a setup for Bran's interior world from very early on. George therefore wanted to keep riffing on Bran's fears as he and his friends tried to navigate a cruel and strange world without the guidance of competent adults. At the Night Fort, we get to explore his fears, and George also gets to build his world, giving us backstory and short horror stories in the form of local legends. All of this is leading to Bran's meeting with Bloodraven, where the boy has to accept darkness in its various forms as part of his training to be a greenseer. So, What about the legends we hear about pertinent to the Nightfort? Lady Gwyn, have you got a favourite?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're all kind of fascinating. I mean, what's just Simeon Star Eyes? I find that fascinating, that with the Hellhounds. I mean, just his... What you hear about Simeon Star Eyes prior to this, you don't realize that he ever had any proximity to the wall or, you know, to the Night Force. So this thing with him having these shining blue eyes just sounds very suspicious in light of that. They're all interesting stories that I'd love to hear the rest of. I think one of the favorite ones that we hear quite a bit of is Mad Axe. It says, here's Bran thinking about the story of Mad Axe. It says, he remembered what old man had said of Mad Axe, how he took his boots off and prowled the castle halls barefoot in the dark with never a sound to tell you where he was, except for the drops of blood that fell from his axe and his elbows and the end of his wet red beard. So there he is, shambling around.
Shambling.
Covered in gore with blood dripping from his axe. I mean,
doesn't Bran hear something and he thinks, oh my God, that's the blood dripping.
He hears dripping. He hears, you know, because he's in the Night Fort, which is disintegrating around him, and he hears some kind of dripping noise and he thinks, it's Mad Axe. I mean, it's just a great kid, you know, horror story. But I why is his beard red and wet and dripping with blood? I don't. Why?
Again, it's the unknown.
They're all good. What about the thing that came in the night?
Yeah, the thing that came in the night, I'll recap people. That's the when it says apprentice boys, that's what it's talking about. These guys were apprentices in the Night's Watch, and they saw a strange thing, but their memories of the thing differed. Three of them died and one went completely mad. A century later, the thing returned with the dead apprentices behind in shackles. I'm sure they were shambling along, Lady Gwyn. Imagine thinking about this when you're at the Night Fort. It's scary stuff and makes us wonder if it's related to the others. It could certainly be about an other, or else comes from a long tradition of natural fear against them. Joe?
Well, one thing about Mad Axe that is actually going to come up later, because I'm doing a viewing party with my patrons about The Shining, and I'm pretty sure Mad Axe is just Jack Torrance. George and Stephen King are very good friends. They have been for a long time. They read each other's stories. I would not be shocked with the way that story reads and the horror that George was kind of like giving a nod to his old buddy Steve and importing one of his most famous characters into his spookiest place. Me and Bookshelf Stud in Sanrixian did a stream about that a while ago. Actually, another Halloween stream where we were talking about all the connections between The Shining and actually Bran's journey to the Night Fort. But my favorite story is actually The Rat Cook. And I think it's not only is it just a very spooky, scary story with cannibalism and all the weird things about turning into rats, which evokes Lovecraft and the Rat in the Walls, but I think the best thing about it is that it's meant to tell you something very deep about Northern culture and the ideas of vengeance and the ideas of murder and guest right, and like sort of defining for you which crimes are worse than others. And it's like guest right was worse than murder, worse than cannibalism. And some of these are just kind of fun. Like the 79 Sentinels tells you something about like the seriousness of abandoning the Night's Watch. Mad Axe is kind of a murder story, but the Rat Cook is really something that George uses, especially with Wyman Manderly, but throughout the story to make sure that his character, that you as a reader understand a very fundamental part about Northern culture that does not really exist in our current time.
Yeah, it really becomes a central device, doesn't it? When we're in Storm of Swords and the Red Wedding happens, and you know, we learn about the rat cook in the next few chapters after the Red Wedding. He's like, well, you know, that chapter's finished, but this is what happens. Vengeance, the northern law and vengeance together. So, yeah, I do think it is a device. And going forward, do we think that this is all a big setup for something really horrific happening at the Night Fort before our very eyes in one of the next couple of books. Lady Gwyn?
Perhaps the sacrificial death by burning of an innocent child?
I mean, it would pair well, right?
We have Melisandre on the stream with us.
Melisandre says...
Almost like there's some sort of insider knowledge.
Oh, no.
Melisandre and George. I mean, you heard it here first.
That's true. And Maddox. We got, actually, yeah, with that light, the Oak Boy, you look a lot like Jack Torrance at the moment, so it all works.
The vampire version.
Pointing wrong way.
Yeah.
So, it is pretty weird that Selyse kind of takes a little shine to this place. Oh, that would make a nice place to live for a while. Okay.
You want to read some of the description? Because it's kind of like, if you just paraphrase the description and it's absolutely.
Do you have some of the description handy?
I have it here. It says, you know, the abandoned night fort has broken towers and a maze of tunnels connecting its vault, vaults and tunnels. It's got the rat-filled great hall has only one remaining wall. The yards have become small forests. A twisted weirwood grows through a hole in the kitchen. There are trees in the stables. It's a ruin. the thing that really got me was the rat-filled great hall with only one remaining wall. Like, what does Selyse think is... Well,
Selyse is looking at it like, well, there's a fixer-upper. Well,
she's her real estate agent.
George, real estate agent, comes up again.
Yeah, her real estate agent, Jon Snow, is like, I don't think you really want this place. She's like, yes, I do. Because reasons. I don't really know what her reasons are.
Stannis, too. He's like, oh, this sounds great. This is definitely where I should live because it's the
just
biggest
it's
castle,
big.
Right?
Yeah.
The weird thing is, though, it's been fixed up since then. Selyse and Stannis have gotten Jon to send the builders with Othel Yarwick, and they claim they have made the Night Fort livable again. And this is a theory I have with that same stream I did with Bookshelf Stud and Senrixian. And I was thinking about the fact that after Jon is killed, those Night's Watch brothers probably can't really hang around Castle Black. They probably have to run somewhere because it was really a small number rather than the way it was portrayed in the show. It was like only like 3 or 4 guys, I think, that did it. So they're going to have to run. And it's noticed that the guys that did it, one of them is Yarwick. So I was wondering if perhaps the Night's Watch traitors are going to run to the Night Fort with Selyse to escape the ensuing battle. And if Jon has to go there, and in his resurrected, maybe a bit more feral, a bit more angry form that most people think is coming, like we were talking about the problems of resurrection, that you come back very horrifically. What if Jon does a Maddox impression and goes room to room hunting down his former brothers, killing them, taking off his shoes beforehand, and all you can hear is the drip, drip of blood off Longclaw?
Wow. There's a new... I thought I had it all. There's a new theory.
There we go.
See,
so what can we call that? John Maddox.
Yeah, John the Maddox. I mean, he does use most of the stories productively, like we were talking about. Maddox hasn't been used productively, right. So I was like, what could be the reason? Well, a massacre at the Night Fort by a very angry Night's Watch brother certainly fits
sure
the bill.
Does. Yeah, you're right. It's a good point, because actually one of the things we talked about right near the end of our thing last night on zombies was whether the 79 Sentinels could wake up, you know, be raised as zombies. I mean, they are bodies that have been stored in essentially ice cells, just like John's corpses, that the Lord Commander's corpses that are kept in ice cells. But unlike them, the 79 Sentinels, as far as we know, are not bound in iron chains. So they've got nothing holding them back should they somehow be released from their imprisonment there. I guess they probably would rise. There's no reason why they wouldn't. They weren't burned like they should have been.
Just like the crypts, the conspicuous corpses sticking around with necromancers on the way.
There's going to be some old-ass skeletons walking around by the end of this story.
Well, no, they'd probably be pretty fresh. Like scientists have found... corpses from thousands of years ago that are relatively whole because they've been preserved by ice sheets. like the famous, what's his name, Otzi or something like that, the guy that they found that had been murdered. He was, when the hiker first found the body, they called in the police because they thought it was a murder. It's like, well, clearly this is a fresh body. And they're like, this guy's been dead for thousands of years.
Ice preserves, man.
Nice. So do we have time for one last section? Joe, are you going to be able to be with us for another 20 minutes?
Yeah, I don't. My thing's not starting until 8 p.m.
Okay. So rather than end it there, we'll have one last horrific section on an event that's just a different kind of horror. You know, we've explored the necromancers and the vivisectionist, but the Red Wedding was really a different kind of horror. So Robb Stark was seeking to make amends with House Frey after breaking a marriage pact arranged by his mother and Walder Frey. Entering the chapter, the reader just senses, it knows that something is amiss, even if you don't know what it is. It's just hitting you around the face. The music's bad, the food's bad, there's just something not right. But few of us were prepared for what came next. The Freys turn on the Starks and on all the guests during the wedding, breaking guest right and murdering many Northerners, including their king, Robb. Catelyn watches on in absolute horror and murders innocent fool Jingerbell as she starts to unravel. Having Kat's POV gave us unfettered access to her degeneration into madness, and the sequence is one of the most horrific in the saga, given the emotive and personal nature of it all. As her throat is cut at the chapter's end, it's difficult to even look at the page. I remember being so horrified. So, guys, personally speaking, how much of a shock was that sequence, Lady Gwyn?
This is a place where words fail me always. I can't even describe it. All I could say was horrific. It just absolutely horrific.
Yeah, it's so bad you can't even describe it. The words can't give justice to the kind of feeling in your stomach that was unleashed. I suspected something was coming, but I kind of ignored all the nagging thoughts in my head. I deluded myself that something like this could not happen, even in a series where George has already pulled a coup de théâtre by removing Ned's head in the first book. But the detail of the final descriptions, the way the scene is being described as she scratches herself and so on, really make it my top horror moment of the series, I think. And Joe, what do you think?
Yeah, it's one of those ones that's hard to even go back to read. Not even if you know it's coming, it still hits you in some really soft places. And I think the way that George sets it up, it's why it's so effective, is that, as many of you may know, he used to be a screenwriter. He worked on, what was it, The Twilight Zone. He also worked on Beauty and the Beast. And one of the things he was very frustrated about, he's written about, is that he could not make interesting things happen to his characters. He could not make bad things stick because the series has to keep going. The protagonists have to come back. Well, not in The Twilight Zone, but definitely Beauty and the Beast. And this is one of those ones where he really, like you said, was a coup de théâtre, where he really breaks the conventions of popular storytelling. There's no way do you think that Rob's going to die. And especially not from Kat's POV, because even Ned, I don't think his death came from his POV, right? It came from Arya's. So he's kept that back, you have this belief it's going to keep going. You really like Robb. A lot of people don't like Kat, but they also have a lot of skin in the game, so to speak, for the Starks, as they are presented as the good guys in the story. And like you were talking about deluding yourself, that's one of those things where when I watch TV, there's a lot of, I smugly think to myself, like, oh, this can't happen. They have to keep the series going. The character has to come back. It's the same problem a lot of people have with, like, the Marvel movies or, like, DC comics with the movies. It's that nothing, it's always the minor characters die. They actually ended up doing that in Game of Thrones to my chagrin, where they end up keeping the big name characters and, oh, which character would die? Oh, it'll always be the least important. Like, when they did the Beyond the Wall thing, it was like, well, which one of these guys is going to die in this surrounded by whites? Well, it'll be Beric. Or no, it'll be Thoros, because he has nothing left to do. And George really broke that. And and it's more than that, though. It's tapping into the experiencing Catelyn's total falling of the world around her and realizing she is dead and there's nothing she can do about it. And it's like I said, what will George do? The worst thing possible. And that was the worst thing possible.
So I was going to ask you guys how it affected you on your first read, looking for sort of personal anecdotes or memories of sort of how it affected you as a human being, Lady Gwyn.
I don't really remember, you know, I probably blocked it out. I mean, it was devastating. I'm sure I wanted to throw my book out the window. Like, that's what a lot of people say. I've heard people say they literally threw their book at the wall and wouldn't pick it up for a while. I just was so, so devastated and probably deeply sad for a long time. But, you know, in terms of horror, what strikes me about this, and I always kind of say this about, you know, when we see, you know, when we watch movies and stuff, the things that could really happen, that's what really bothers me. You know, I could watch anything that's, you know, far out and is very unlikely to happen and doesn't bother me. But then the things that are possible really affect me very deeply. And madness is, as we see with Cat, you know, that's quite a different kind of horror. You've got violence and blood and gore and all that stuff is bad enough, but the breaking of Catelyn's mind is just one of those elements that we as humans with our fragile minds and psyches can relate to on a very basic level. And I think we were talking earlier about whether George has used this kind of theme in some of his short stories. I know I was thinking of all the times that he uses grief and loneliness, which walk a very fine line with madness. Those are very, very prevalent themes in most of his short stories, mental fragility, that sort of thing. And Joe, you mentioned one story that I hadn't read, where he used a kind of a madness theme.
Oh, This Tower of Ashes.
Go read that one.
I remember I read it late at night. I was on my own and I couldn't believe, you know, what I was reading, the horror of it. And I never felt so punched in the gut by a writer. I didn't have anyone that I could sort of talk to about it, and it felt like a great burden, you know. I remember having a meal with my family and just wanting to tell them, you know, Robb Stark's dead, you know. they wouldn't have known what I was talking about. So I just had this kind of nagging emptiness for days where I was just privy to this horror and I couldn't really get out of my system by talking to anyone about it. Joe?
So one thing I was trying to put it in perspective was, like, what other stories have had this happened in where I felt similarly betrayed and just, like, totally hurt by what happened. And there aren't really any, but maybe the closest for a lot of readers was in Lord of the Rings when Gandalf died. For a lot of people, especially because he read it young and Gandalf is a favorite character, people were like, oh no, where's the story going to go after this? And then he comes back and everything's great. But the Red Wedding is almost like if the Fellowship died and then you had to keep going with the story, the entire Fellowship, if they all just bit it right there, if they all died in the Mines of Moria.
What?
It's like, who's the story about now? Like, what's going to happen? And rather than just, like, playing with that as an intellectual exercise, George said, yeah, let's do that. Let's kill basically the main characters in the Storm of Swords, and then we'll just move forward from there.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, like you said, who's the story about now? You know, what? You've just taken the King of the North out of the game.
The War of the Five Kings. Like, that was what the first three books are about. And George is like, remember those guys north of the wall?
Ha, 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 ha. Just going to sweep the board clean.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's been a horrific evening so far, but hopefully horrific in the right ways. I think we're going to end proceedings by a reading. When Lady Gwyn did this reading in our Catelyn episode, I think it was one of our best ones. I think listeners have said that. So we thought we'd have a crack at doing it live, Lady Gwyn. What do you say? The Red Wedding? Try not to claw your face?
I won't claw my face and I won't scream. Because in that episode, I really did scream. But yeah, I'll read it. I'll try. Give it a go. A man in dark armor and a pale pink cloak, spotted with blood, stepped up to Rob. Jaime Lannister sends his regards. He thrust his longsword through her son's heart and twisted. Rob had broken his word, but Catelyn kept hers. She tugged hard on Aegon's hair and sawed at his neck until the blade grated on bone. Blood ran hot over her fingers. His little bells were ringing, 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 and the drum went boom, doom, boom. Finally, someone took the knife away from her. The tears burned like vinegar as they ran down her cheeks. 10 fierce ravens were raking her face with sharp talons and tearing off strips of flesh, leaving deep furrows that ran red with blood. She could taste it on her lips. "It hurts so much," she thought. "Our children, Ned. All our sweet babes. Rickon, Bran, Arya, Sansa, Rob. Rob. Please, Ned, please, make it stop. Make it stop hurting." The white tears and the red ones ran together until her face was torn and tattered, the face that Ned had loved. Catelyn Stark raised her hands and watched the blood run down her long fingers over her wrists beneath the sleeves of her gown. Slow red worms crawled along her arms and under her clothes. "It tickles." That made her laugh until she screamed. "Mad," someone said. "She's lost her wits." And someone else said, "Make an end." And a hand grabbed her scalp, just as she'd done with Jingle Bell. And she thought, "No, don't cut my hair. Ned loves my hair." Then the steel was at her throat, and its bite was red and cold. Oof. Sorry.
Ouch. Thank you, Lady Gwyn. That was very emotive.
I'm sorry.
You hit all the all the right notes.
So I don't.
She would have screamed at the parts when she screamed, but it would be too loud for the mic. So it was a kind of muted version, but very good.
It was more I don't say more fun, but you know. It was fun when I could scream.
More fun.
yes.
Red Wedding to make fun. It fun. Good one, Lady Gwyn.
Yeah.
Okay, so guys, if you're still with us and you haven't, you didn't leave early during the Red Wedding reading, it wasn't too depressing for you. We wish you a happy Halloween. Thank you for choosing to be with us. And enjoying our inaugural live stream. I think we could do this every year. So, Joe, thank you so much for joining us. You're a fantastic guest, always sharp. Why don't you tell us about your YouTube channel and what you're up to, what your plans are, what you've got coming out?
Sure. As always, I am very happy to join you guys on whatever you ask me to do. On my YouTube channel, I post a couple of kind of tinfoil theories during this stream. That's kind of what I tend to do. I like writing theories and character analysis during the whole quarantine thing, which isn't really a quarantine anymore, I've been doing quite a lot of live streams, weekly ones, choosing random topics and going for it. Lady Gwyn was on just a little while ago talking about Lyanna Stark, which was a very lovely time. Upcoming for me, actually later tonight, if you guys, some of my patrons are here, so at 8 p.m. we're going to be doing a watch party with The Shining, as I talked about earlier. 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, so about an hour and so from now. Upcoming videos, I'm going to be putting out dual videos. So the first one is going to be a brief history of the five-year gap and what it is and why it came about. And the reason for that is because the second video is a continuation of my series on Pretty Maris and Brienne and Kago, Corpse Killer, and Sandor. I'll be unmasking, like a Scooby-Doo villain, who the Tattered Prince truly is. And I get tired of explaining in each video what the five-year gap is. So I'm just going to make a video saying what it is very briefly and just be like, just go watch this. And then, so I don't have to explain it again like I've had to in the other two. Also with those, there'll be some giveaways going on with that, as well as some channel relaunch sort of things. Sanrixian has provided a lot of new art and stuff that I'm officially going to put up once that goes live, along with some other goodies. So you have that stuff to go to look forward to. I think my next video after that will be... What will it be? Oh, yeah, it's going to be... I kind of alluded to it during this live stream, the idea that for some reason it seems like Lady Stoneheart wants to resurrect Robb Stark. And I just wanted to explore that more. Could it happen? Why could it happen? What would be the effect? So look forward to those, you guys.
Thank you. Yeah, that one will be.
A lot of more horror, yeah. Like I was saying, it's hard to read a George R. R. Martin story and not have horror come up, because it's pretty much one of the primary themes.
A big influence of his, so. So this is all, it's always a good time to talk about, you know, his influences, etc. this time of year. So anyways, thank you so much for being here, Joe. I do appreciate it. Just so you know, what's folks who are listening, what's going on for us, our installment 3 of our Dance of the Dragon series with History Westeros came out today while we were talking. The podcast version was released about 45 minutes ago, and about a half an hour ago, the YouTube video dropped. We ran over. It was supposed to go from one to the other, but we ran over, which was fine. It's a pre-recorded video, but it's right now premiering over on the History of Westeros YouTube channel. So we are actually going to hop over there and chat with people for a little bit. And that's what's going on with us. And I'm sure we'll be back with another live stream sometime next month. Date and topic to be determined, but we're going to be diving back into our Winds of Winter primer next. So we look forward to that.
So you guys have a great Halloween evening. Thanks for all your support of the live stream so far. There will be more, and a special shout out to all of our chat room mods. We couldn't do this without you guys, so we really appreciate it. Thanks to each and every one of our patrons who continue to support us and keep Radio Westeros afloat. If you want to support us as a patron too, check out our campaign on Patreon, which does include all manner of incentives, early access, shout outs, and so on. Go and check it out, guys. So we'll see you soon. Enjoy the Dance of the Dragons 3 that's out now, as Lady Gwyn said, and have a great Halloween night.
See you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.